Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready? Connor, are you ready?
I'm ready, baby.
This is exciting. How in the world, Connor Listoka, I'm Mike Nelson, by the way. This is 372 pages. We'll never get back. And what are we doing, Connor?
We're starting our third ever book, the long-awaited follow-up. First, there was Ready Player One. Then there was Armada. Two best-selling New York Times million-selling books.
Best book of the year on many people's lists.
Acclaimed. Well, not so acclaimed, but movie rights sold. Seven figures. Just translated into 48 different languages, I'm sure. How do you follow up those books? Like, what would translate well to this podcast to follow those books up? We took some suggestions.
We thought about it a long time. We went to our separate sort of like those Star Wars beehive caves that that Luke was in, and we just sat with ourselves and our thoughts.
Yes.
Because we knew the importance, the monumental importance of how we made this choice. I don't know. I just started to read and chant, and suddenly it hit me.
And it hit you. What hit you? The name of the next book to do?
Yes.
Oh, all right.
It did. And I telepathically communicated it to you.
Yes, I was sitting there. I was catching flies with tweezers. I had a stack of them about 8 feet high.
So it was a regular old Tuesday for you.
Yes,
it was nothing different about it.
I wasn't in one of those caves. That was just I was sitting here waiting for you to call.
And the title that we came up with is what, Connor? Should I give you a drum roll or how do I do this?
That would be good.
We don't have the capability to do a drum roll. So just
What is the Patreon paying for?
I'll lay one in post. So right here, we'll pause for a second and then you'll hear the drum roll that I rolled in. Okay, now go ahead.
Our next book is called The Eye of Argon.
Eye of Argon.
I recognize that from the New York Times bestseller list. The movie version? No? Not,
no.
Not a familiar title?
There are some people out there, I'm sure, who are cheering and saying, oh, finally, at last. Yes. And there are others going, what in the name of Sam Scratch are you talking about? What
Someone
is the Eye of Argon?
Swerved off of the road and is weeping as their dream come true. I think one person suggested this. I don't remember who it was, but the Eye of Argon is a very unique piece of outsider art. It is a book. It's a very short book. So we're not going to do our complete run of this. It's probably going to give us two episodes, maybe three tops. But it is a novella that was written in 1970, and it was published. It's not just a self-published book. It was actually published in issue 10 of the Journal of the Ozark Science Fiction Association.
And this is a real thing.
Yeah, that was a real thing. I guess it had been around for 10 issues at that point in time. I'm not sure if it stuck around that much longer. And it sounds impressive, you know, the Ozark Science Fiction Association. But I've seen a picture of the actual magazine it was published in, and it looks like a 9-year-old gained access to his father's typewriter and decided to put out a zine. It was very much a zine, essentially.
It's sub band flyer levels of design.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's illustrations in it that remind me a lot of your sort of trademark illustrations.
Oh, like
your hideous, like grotesque people that I don't think yours are sort of meant to be, you know, you're not like, this is a representative self-portrait. This is just sort of my weird little style. All the pictures in this appeared to be in that style. It looks very much like All Work and No Play, Jack Torrance's manuscript. But the key detail that we are leaving out here is that it was written by a 16-year-old.
Right. And it gained quite a bit of a following after that. It sort of grew and grew, right? It traveled around sci-fi conventions and became a game.
Yeah, it was a... it was very much a word of mouth thing, and people sort of transcribed it and passed it around, and people would take it to a sci-fi convention, and their whole shtick was essentially, it was like a telephone game almost, where they would read it until someone laughed out loud, and then that person would be out. So it's evidently very, very bad. And is it cruel to read something that a 16-year-old wrote and talk about it in this podcast?
Well, I thought about that for a minute, but then the knowledge came to me that the gentleman who is deceased, Jim Theis, T-H-E-I-S, I believe.
Yeah, but yeah. I guess it's like Theis.
He has passed away, but he got in on the joke when he was a little bit older. Apparently not right away. I'm sure it was kind of like the lightsaber dude in his garage or whatever.
Right,
it was probably pretty damaging up front, but then realized, look, I was 16, who cares? And so he got in on the fun. And to me, that mitigates a lot of it. You're not pulling someone out of the shadows who doesn't want to be seen and made fun of. In fact, he was part of the fun, so.
Sure, yeah. And like, we've all done stuff in high school that would have been probably embarrassing if you had retrieved it and showed it to us later. But, he sent this off. It got published. That's an accomplishment. Like, I'm not sure how many things the Ozark Science Fiction Association was turning down at this point, but.
right. And they also mentioned something about the manuscript itself was sort of feverishly scribbled on, and the way that it was typed out, even the typing itself somehow added to the joy of the experience.
Right. It was sort of typo riddled, and then the people would transcribe it, and that was riddled with typos or errors. And evidently the last chapter of it was missing, just sort of like, there were used to be times when you would download like a song from Napster, and it would just have been a bad version of the song that cut off like with 30 seconds remaining. But that, for whatever reason, was the main version that traveled around. So it was a very early on, like before the internet, sort of like viral chain lettery sort of thing. So it's kind of a cool artifact of that era.
Yeah, it reminds me a little of when I was a kid, somebody would hand you a mimeographed like cartoon joke, and it would be something tasteless, but right. The mimeograph would be so splotchy, you'd be like, what does that say?
Right.
And I don't know where people were getting them, who was making them, but then they would be copies of copies of copies. And this is kind of like that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And then it traveled into like the Usenet, that sort of pre-World Wide Web era. So it really covers a lot of forgotten portions of our culture, like all the people that were reading this at sci-fi conventions. Like now you hear sci-fi convention, you're like, oh, Comic-Con, like they're probably in the room next to, Chris Pine. Like, it's like, no, these were science fiction conventions back when that was like, they wouldn't give you like the Howard Johnson convention room. They'd be like, get out of here. Like, you weirdos, like take this under the bridge. Right. If you're dressed as a wizard, this was not a respectable thing to be attending.
Yeah. These were very, very sort of, secretive downstream events. I've been to a few of them years ago, the smaller conventions. And there is something about those where you feel like something weird is probably going to happen here. That's what I figure these were like.
Just nervous, sweaty energy, like people sort of like so. Getting their cloaks caught in the hinges of the doors and stuff. But like, so the way that I sort of, people recommended us a ton of books for this on Facebook and Twitter and stuff. And a lot of times we see this at Riff Tracks too. People will recommend stuff. They'll be like, this is perfect for you. This is, they'll say that all the time. What's the hit rate you would say on those claims?
Oh gosh. If it's 2%, I'd be shocked.
Right. People have an interesting, sometimes they just don't take into consideration like things like, I remember at one convention at a Comic-Con, we were taking suggestions to the mic and some guy was like, I've got the perfect movie for you. It's really boring. And you're like, boring, you say? So it's like, well, you sort of have to, there has to be sort of a weird spark that like lends itself to sort of the ideal thing that we're looking for. Maybe some other books people suggested would have that too. But what convinced me that this might be the ideal thing was it is available on Amazon. You can buy, I guess, a printed version. It's also available for free on a website that we'll link to. But two Amazon reviews, I'm going to paraphrase. The first one says, I'm only giving it one star since we are not allowed the option of negative stars. This is a must-read book. This is the literary version of Manos, The Hands of Fate, a must read, and then the trash.
Yep.
So that's lofty
praise.
That
is high praise indeed.
And then the next one says, The Eye of Argon is a legend in science fiction and fantasy circles, a novelette so bad that it's good, a sort of literary Plan 9 from outer space.
Yep.
So, those have been, comparisons that have been tossed around for a long time, and those are some of the best bad movies that we've ever seen. So that was sort of what put me over the edge, and the fact that it's not very long, too. If it's not good, we'll be done with it quickly. But it seemed like it was sort of a fitting follow-up to these giant corporate Ernest Cline novels.
Yeah, and the fact that it has a track record of people saying, you have to see this. It's like, The Room. How do you explain the magic that is The Room? It's just everyone who sees it says to the next person, you have to see this. And this seems like this is what this book is.
Yeah, it's one person's insane vision that they release to the world. There's no corporate editors or anything like that involved. It's pure nonsense. And
be clear, though, there was no editor involved on any Ernest Cline book either.
That's true. It's the same fictional editor. He's omnipresent. He's within the hearts of us all.
Yes.
But there was one more thing. So there's like one website that looks like it was, it looked like they saw GeoCities and were like, nah, too corporate for me. That hosts the PDF and Mobi and EPUB file of all this. But they link to some information about it. They have scans of it all. But then one of the things they link to is called their MST3K commentary. So some guy on the Usenet went through, took the book and sort of added his own riffs through this thing and like has a whole fiction with skits and the characters and everything like that, which is another good sign, I think.
Are we just going to take those and perform them ourselves, right?
Right. That's right, yes.
All right, good.
But the description of it tickled me just because he's explaining this to people who don't know what it is. Mystery Science Theater 3000, a TV program devoted to sarcastic commentary on bad films, was definitely an acquired taste. The Eye of Argon hardly needs this treatment to make it funny, but the link is included for the masochists among us.
Ah, so he's doing the old, one of our favorite lines. The jokes write themselves.
Yes, right.
Do that's they? Always, well, that's then always what sense. Am I doing here?
Right. But yeah, so if you're listening to this, we're doing something new where we've tried to put our episodes up early on Patreon. So if you're listening to this, you hopefully are listening to it on Patreon. You've gotten this a few days earlier than everyone else. Our Patreon is patreon.com/372pages, and you can support this for just a few bucks a month, and you will be able to get the episodes earlier. You can then write us emails earlier. The way the emails work is they sort of come in and I'll respond to the first couple, and then like they'll be overwhelming, and so I'll stop. So it's an advantage to get your emails in quickly. But it's going to be free for everyone else just a couple days later.
Free, but let's face it, a little bit stale. You're going to want to be in on the ground floor of this baby.
Yeah, I mean, the way that everything moves this fast is just, it will have, people will be talking about so many other things by the time you get your hands on it, and your coworkers around the water cooler will be like, my God, he's talking about that? That is so many days old. So it behooves you to hop on Patreon, and just a few bucks, it's once per month, it'll bill you, and it'll get to show us some support, too.
Yeah, you don't want to be the guy who's trying to get a conversation going about Gone Girl like this year, Like, hey, I just saw this great movie. Did you guys watch it? No, you want to be right there. You want to be on it. So we'd love it if you supported us on the Patreon thing, and it's a fun little experiment. So thanks for checking it out with us.
Yeah, we have no idea how it's going to work, but if it does, that'd be great. If not, it will be a massive public embarrassment, because I think everyone can see how many people are chipping in to do it. But yeah, we're trying something weird with this book. So if you enjoy it, come on and help us out.
Well, I mean, look, it's out there, right? But if nobody supports it, then not many eyes were on it. So the embarrassment I feel is sort of limited.
Right.
Someone would have to then, paste it somewhere else important where a lot of people saw it to humiliate us. So,
right.
Which I suppose is a possibility.
They could take it to sci-fi conventions and do public readings of it. And when they start laughing, that would be a good comeuppance for us, I suppose. Yeah.
Have you heard about this failed podcast? Oh, my God.
Yeah. So something we did on our first ever episode, I think, was just we established sort of a baseline for our tastes, because we wanted you to be able to sort of calibrate your own tastes with ours. Because if we were like, this book is terrible and it references all this weird pop culture. We wanted you to be able to see where we were coming from.
Right. So I forget what was on our original list, but hit me with yours and let's calibrate. I assume you've come up with a new batch.
I have. And so they're more, since this is a sort of sci-fi fantasy book, I thought it would be appropriate to just, since we're going to be trafficking in that realm, to just do some things within that sort of genre to see what your thoughts are about the world of fantasy. So the first one that I have, what do you think about Tom Bombadil?
Oh man, I'm sincerely sad that he was left out of the feature films.
Okay.
Because it is such a, so obviously in the books, a swing and a miss from Tolkien. Like, I know there are many people, there's books have been written about how, no, it's the most brilliant character ever.
There have been.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Like there's a whole theories about who he represents and what he, you know, it, that, yeah. Anyway, you could look it up online. Right. Tons
sure,
of stuff.
Yeah.
But just reading the book, you go along and you meet this weird character in yellow boots who's jumping up and down and singing. And he has more power than anyone in the entire world. He can take the ring and just make it disappear. And then the characters, he rescues them from a ghost and then he's just gone. And they right. kind of mention him again. And then the great councils happen and they go, hey, what about Tom Bombadil? It's like, I think he's gathering honey and singing a song right now. Wow. So yeah, we can't bother him. So yeah, he's obviously a character that he sort of wrote in and then went, yeah, it's not working. And so, but he just left him in.
But so he's pretty like the first like 10th of the book, right? Is when he shows up.
Yeah. And he has like a really hot wife who dances around with no shoes on. And you just know that he's got it made and he's super powerful. It's a weird character. So yeah. That's why trying to weave that into the movie would have been absolutely hysterical. I wish right. they had tried it.
So essentially, your thoughts on him are you're delighted by it, but of course, there's no actual artistic merit to the choice.
I don't think so. No.
All right, next on the list, JRPGs.
Huh?
That stands for Japanese role playing games.
And so oh, what?
Maybe we can just take the "huh" as your response there. But that's stuff like Final Fantasy would probably be the ideal, the platonic ideal of that, or the Earthbound Mother series, or what is the one that I'm trying to think of? Chrono Trigger. No, not ringing any bells.
You know, Final Fantasy. I you know, I maybe could summon up. Isn't the dude from Ready Player One his avatar
yeah.
from that?
I think that looks pretty similar to whatever they were going
okay.
for.
Well, then I hate it.
All right. Let's see. Number three is Disenchantment, the recent series on Netflix from Matt Groening that's set in a fantasy realm.
Oh, man. I mean, I think we watched one or two together.
Mm-hmm.
I believe I was napping during the thing. I don't think that I laughed, and I wonder, was I supposed to? So
it was odd, you know, it was a sort of Homer Simpson sort of looking around being like, what am I watching here? How did this come to pass?
Yeah, it's a strange mix, but, yeah, so I'd give it I give it a thumbs down.
Yeah. How about non-six-sided dice?
I don't think I've ever held non-six-sided dice in my hands.
Oh, wow.
It's possible. It's possible someone gave me one and then I, you know, did a Finchy and threw it over the barn or something.
The roof of the pub. Okay.
But I don't think I've ever held them.
Okay. Would you be, interested in playing a Dungeons & Dragons campaign?
I would not. Thank you very much. If the sample lady came up to me at the grocery store, would you like to play a Dungeons and Dragons game? I politely hold up my hand and say, thank you. No,
I'm good. Okay. All right. Well, the last one that I have for you is the King's Quest series of games from Sierra Adventures in the.
I understand the word king. I understand the word quest. The rest of it, I have never heard of.
You never played those? Those were like the original point and click adventure games where you would you would walk your character over to something and be like, you know, pick banana, eat banana, and then you would see what would happen. And
I played for a minute. I played some version of that. many, many, many years ago. And I think I quickly got bored with that.
They can be, they were something that I liked a lot growing up, but they were also like very difficult. And they, I don't think that a lot of them held up especially well for the modern day gamer. They could be very frustrating where it's just like, I was supposed to put the, you know, the pineapple like on top of the monkey and that would open up the gate to the hell realm. Like, all right, I guess if I tried literally every combination of items, I could have eventually figured that out. But
yeah, I, and you had to get it exactly right in text form, right? You had to keep trying things.
Oh, yeah, well, they eventually moved to mouse, but like the text parser, you know, they sort of started as just text, and then, you know, King's Quest sort of pioneered the actual character walking around. But yeah, if you typed like pick bananas instead of pick banana, you would have been just like stuck there and impossible to continue on. And you would have had to get your mimeographed copy of the hint book in order to make any more progress.
Fun.
All right. Well, I think the only thing on this list that you liked was Tom Bombadil. So there, that's a calibrate yourself accordingly, folks.
Yes. All right. Well, you're on the dock now.
All right.
Have you ever seen in any form the C.S. Lewis books, The Chronicles of Narnia? Did you see the BBC version of it, live action from, I think, the 80s?
I read the first one, and I always would get like halfway through Prince Caspian. I think maybe I could have seen a videotape of the one, either as a school thing or at a friend's house for the sleepover. I know I saw the live action movie that came out.
All right.
But I don't know if I ever saw the 80s version. Was it like it was BBC? So they may have shown it on PBS or something.
Yeah, it came on PBS and they had ridiculous costumes.
Yeah, like I'm picturing like a very crappy lion. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And your thoughts on that?
It didn't make a impression on me, but I always, you know, I had the box set of the books and I would always be like, bring them, you know, when we drive to my grandmother's house in Pennsylvania, I'd be like, I'm bringing along, you know, the Dawn Treader this time. I'm going to make it happen. But it just didn't have the, it never looped me in. I'm not sure what it was. Because I liked The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, but it just never, I never took the plunge, so to speak.
Okay, so sort of lukewarm on that classic.
Yes, yes. Not a big part of my growing up.
Okay, this is tangential, but it's important, I think, in the same way that the dice one was. Have you ever drank any liquid from a pewter mug?
This is a good question.
Thank you very much.
Because I have a mug that they gave me on our neighborhood swim team when you finished high school. That was the last year you could swim for them, and went off to college, and they would give you one engraved with the years you had swam for the swim team. It might be pewter. There's a chance that it's some weird alloy, or it's just like encased in it, and it might be poisonous. I know that it has a plastic bottom, so they did not go all the way through. It's like a see-through glass bottom boat.
Okay. And so it's not sci-fi themed at all. Usually there's some sort of like fantasy sci-fi pewter mug.
It's not like a goblet or a chalice, but it's got a handle and it's got some heft to it. And I have a distinct memory of going outside, like probably the first couple months of college, and drinking rum and flat Coke out of it, like on the picnic table in front of our dorm, like during the day.
Two follow-ups that I think will make this clear. Have you ever drank from a leather mug of any kind?
Absolutely not. That sounds okay. Deeply unappealing.
All right. That's kind of a Renaissance festival thing. And then a follow-up just to make sure we seal this question off. Have you ever brewed mead?
I have. Yeah. I have. You might have been with me. We went over to our coworker's house.
That's correct.
It was the first thing that I ever brewed. He was mead is, you know, brewing mead is a process of just pouring a whole shitload of honey into a boiling water and you cool it and toss the yeast in.
Yeah, but it is the reason I raise this question is there was a guy around in college who I knew who was trying to introduce me to the kinds of sci-fi that I think and fantasy that I assume we're about to be embarking on. And he was a fellow with thigh-high leather boots. Had his own pewter mug that he would bring to parties. brewed his own mead and was once arrested for walking down the street with a chainmail and a broadsword that he himself had made.
What?
Was given a weapons
charge. I thought this was America. Wow.
And I just wanted to make sure that none of those things are in your past. I'm assuming that, you know, now it's clear they are not.
Yeah. I mean, you know, mead has sort of been one of those things that, like, you'd see in, like, food magazines or something like that, like always a sidebar, like mead is the new hot beverage. And you're like, mead is not the new hot beverage. Just like, you know, shrubs were the new hot cocktail thing.
Years ago.
But, you know, there are places here, like you can go into a store and buy different kinds of mead that comes in cans and is expensive. And it's more mainstream than it probably ever used to be, but it's not something that, your average Joe is coming home and, you know, the neighbor in Office Space is not cracking one of those when Peter comes over to ask him if anyone ever says, do you ever have a case of the Mondays?
Exactly. All right. Just a few more just to probe your what is your favorite Arthur C. Clarke novel?
I mean, I have never read an Arthur C. Clarke novel. So that's important. I know that he wrote 2001 and 2010. And I don't think I could name another one. There's probably some I don't realize, but we were talking about 2001 earlier this week. I'm skeptical that it holds up from the point of view of the non-stoned out of your gourd viewer.
I watched it recently and was profoundly irritated by it. even though, you know, the visuals, again, it's like, I guess, cool visuals. If you like, you know, sort of staring at blacklight posters. I don't know. Right. There's probably some, and they're composed in a way they look really clean. Like obviously a lot of high tech stuff went into it, and you can admire it while at the same time going, no, thank you. Not for me.
There's a reason you go to the movies at the planetarium that they show on like the curved IMAX screen and that they last half an hour is because you don't want to go and just sort of look at a solar eclipse happen in real time, like for longer than that. But we did make the discovery recently that David of David and Hazel was in 2001. Kevin somehow noticed that.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I can't believe we missed that before.
That's really incredible. I last time I flew on a plane that had like its own embedded in like seat viewer, they had like a whole library of movies you could watch. So it was, you know, on smaller than your, it was the size of a large phone. And one of the options for a movie you could watch was 2001. And I was like, well, that is absolutely, knowing how prickly Stanley Kubrick was, that would have been like the most blasphemous thing he could have possibly imagined, is trying to watch that movie, you know, while guys are climbing over you to go to the bathroom on this size of a postcard size screen.
Right. All right. Well, finally, have you ever read a trilogy of any kind?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I just finished one. I just finished the Three Body Problem trilogy, which is a Chinese author. I don't remember his name, but I finished it like 3 weeks ago. It was pretty incredible. It had a lot of stuff I did not understand about dark matter and the fourth through 10th dimensions and light speed and all that stuff. But it was also full of a lot of other cool concepts. Sort of eye-opening about the size and scope of the universe.
So it's science-based, not well, it's fiction, right?
Oh, yeah, it's fiction. I think there was, you know, there was a lot of stuff in there that seemed like he had done his research into how, like, light speed would work and how light would curve around objects and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, it was definitely fake. It involves an alien race and all that sort of thing. But
so you just finished a science fiction trilogy. So
I did.
You're in the camp. All right. So you could like this book.
It's a distinct possibility. I'm sure that if he had a better reception to his novel being published in the Ozark science fiction journal, he might have actually completed the trilogy. Who knows? Maybe we'll inspire some people to complete the trilogy. That's sort of what I'm hoping with this, is that this we can direct some new attention towards this work and maybe, you know, some new appreciation of it, unearth some of those old convention readings, or maybe inspire them to start happening again.
And kind of like, you know, Mahler's symphony, when he didn't finish the 10th, that someone will come along, a Derek Cook will come along and make his own version of it. Is that what you're...
It was like the syllables, those exact syllables were about to escape my mouth.
And final bonus question, George R.R. Martin, where do you stand? The books.
Sure. Yeah, you know, I've read all of the Game of Thrones books. I don't think I would probably read the next one, when and if he ever gets around to finishing that. It's just like you're asking a lot at this point for those long books and delving into a story that you sort of have already seen told, assuming that the story is the same as how the TV shows go, is just not something that I think is super worth doing. You know, I'm not going to read the novelization of this year's World Series if it comes out in 2 years, because I'll already have seen the events happening. And the George R. R. Martin you weren't really reading it for the prose filled journey into these characters. For the most part, it was very, very plot driven. And you were sort of like, all right, quit describing the capons, quit describing the jerkins. Just like, tell me if this guy is going to turn into a rock man or not. Because that's how I feel about it.
Right. And was that a trilogy up to this point? I don't know how the books went out.
I don't know what he had ever planned to do at the start, but I think it's a planned, you know, septilogy or whatever. I think that he's done five books.
Oh, he's done five. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
And is planning on doing two more in theory. But I think he's probably too busy, you know, rubbing shoulders with you know, Khaleesi and all those people to get any work done, sitting courtside at Phoenix Suns games and stuff.
Right, right. Yeah, he must have that in common with his namesake, J.R.R. Tolkien, obviously the songs. No human has ever read the book and, like, just dutifully right. read all the songs they sing. And then the other thing is landscape descriptions. They came over the rise. Below them was a spread of trees that flattened out into a plain. Beyond that was, it's like, what are you doing?
Oh my God.
Yeah. It's impossible to put into your mind. Like, he must have just loved the landscape he was describing, but it was just painful.
Oh man. Yeah, I haven't read The Lord of the Rings in a long, long time just because of the books, and I'm not sure that I will, but that's that is something that I remember, is like the italic sections where they're singing songs was always like, oh my God, it's keeping going. I'm flipping ahead to see it and it's still there.
So there it is.
I think that this guy we're reading, about to read, probably is deeply familiar with Tolkien, and I'm not sure that his takeaway from all that stuff was that it was bad. So I think we might see him attempting to sort of ape it in what I'm sure is not going to be a very, very competent style.
Well, I look forward to it. And now the folks out there, you know, if our tastes are off of yours, then don't trust us when we critique this book. But if you think you could be, you know, if the Venn diagram of our tastes lines up, I think you'll enjoy this.
Right. If you're gripping your leather mug while poring over your copy of Arthur C. Clarke's Great Unknown Novel, like, all right, maybe you're already familiar with The Eye of Argon. So that could be write us and tell us, because that would be even more fun if people are really angry about this.
Well, I think that's it. Should we just thank our Patreon people? And
Yeah. Thanks to everyone who supported the Patreon. It's a new weird thing, and we're not sure entirely how it's going to work, but we deeply and honestly appreciate it. So thank you for that.
And ladies and gentlemen.
Read chapter 4. Read up to chapter 4 of The Eye of Argon.
Chapter 4, The Eye of Argon, and we'll be back. 372 pages. We'll never get back.